Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, August 5th, 2016. Do you have a moment for a little recap of the creeping police state here in the United States of America? Green instead of gang bandanas, FBI spying on us through the radio antennas, and I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy, I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P, I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons, dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organized
a blistering indictment from Dead Prez. It's called Police State, and I am stunned by the news just this week of the creeping authoritarianism in law enforcement in this country, both at the local level and the federal government. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to recap some of these critical events. In Chicago, they released videos that are only about a week old, and that's progress. But these videos show two officers firing their guns at a stolen car moments before the 18-year-old driver crashed, ran from the scene, and then was killed, shot in the back, by another officer. Now, Paul O'Neill, the 18-year-old suspect here, did steal a car. He was caught behind the wheel of a stolen Jaguar. And as the cops tried to corner him, well, at one point, he basically approached these two officers in an SUV head-on, and as they got out with their guns drawn, the driver of the Jaguar skirted around them, narrowly missing one of the officers, and both of the cops opened fire as it sped away. Now, this may or may not be a violation of police protocols, because they're only supposed to shoot if the automobile is being used as a weapon. And in this case, that might be arguable. But seconds later, the 18-year-old driver crashed the Jag, got out of it, and ran behind a nearby house. More shots rang out, and then the officers could be seen gathering around O'Neill as he lay on the ground. And one of the officers picked up on a body cam says, "They shot at us, too, right?" Well, in fact, no. No shots had come from the Jaguar or from anyone else. Only police had fired on this scene, and an attorney for the O'Neill family referred to this as an execution. Quote, "We just came from watching Chicago police officers execute Paul O'Neill. It's one of the most horrific things I've seen, aside from being in a movie. These police officers decided to play judge, jury, and executioner." And the administrator of the Independent Police Review Agency in Chicago, Sharon Fairley, called the videos shocking and disturbing. Now, the videos don't show the fatal shooting itself. That officer, who is unnamed, was wearing a body camera, but he either turned it off or it malfunctioned. But the signal difference here, when you compare this to the Laquan McDonald case, is that the video was released 8 days after the shooting, instead of the prolonged effort that it took to win release of the McDonald video. So, this is another case of the deadly shooting of an unarmed suspect. I don't know the race of Paul O'Neill. I don't know the race of the officers who were involved in this case. But the new police superintendent, African-American Eddie Johnson, said the three officers, whose names have not been released, appeared to have violated departmental policy, and they were stripped of police authority pending an investigation. And maybe you've seen coverage of the case from Baltimore earlier this week, a young woman, 22 or 23-year-old Corin Gaines. And if you've seen her picture on Facebook, she was a beautiful young woman and a kind of a fashionista. And it turns out that the incident where police came into her apartment, she was brandishing a shotgun, and after a protracted standoff, she threatened to shoot the cops, and they shot her first. And they wounded her baby boy, who was sitting there in her arms. And as you may know, this case drew notoriety because she was posting videos of this confrontation on Facebook as it was occurring. Turns out she wasn't streaming live. She was shooting videos and then posting them. And the Baltimore cops got Facebook to suspend her account during this showdown. That raises separate questions that we might deal with at another time. But what is fascinating here is that we're now learning that Corin Gaines, in her early 20s, was a victim of lead poisoning. Now, the national standard, according for the Center for Disease Control, is that if you have a blood level of lead above 5 milligrams, or I'm sorry, micrograms, per, what is the level here? It's per demiliter, deciliter, I'm sorry. 10 micrograms per deciliter is a very high level, and Corin Gaines had a level, a lifetime lead level reading of 12 micrograms per deciliter. So she clearly was carrying poison in her system. And one of the outcomes of lead poisoning is mental illness. And according to experts, the cognitive effects, negative cognitive effects of lead have been widely documented. A study at the University of Pittsburgh comparing the lead levels of 146 juvenile convicts with a control group of 146 youths without a criminal record found the delinquents had significantly higher concentrations of lead. Freddie Gray, whose death in police custody in Baltimore last year, also suffered from the effects of lead poisoning. So when Corin Gaines was pulled over in March, she had an unregistered vehicle, and as I recall, she had put something weird up in place of a license plate, like a challenge to the cops. Well, she filmed that incident, refused to leave her car at the time, had to be physically pulled out, and she claimed that she was kidnapped and held in isolation for 2 days without food or water before she was released. Then they called her to court. She didn't appear, so officers came to her apartment to serve warrants, and that's when the showdown occurred, and she was there with a shotgun. And so, I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't really evaluate whether a less lethal approach might have been used. But we didn't hear about any beanbag, any taser, any tear gas, or any other effort that was used to disarm and subdue Corin Gaines before she was shot by police. More than 630 Americans have been shot by police this year, according to the Guardian newspaper. Yesterday, I shared with you my outrage at the two FBI frame-ups that we learned about this week, the D.C. Metro cop named Nick Young and the 18-year-old Arizona boy who is developmentally, mentally challenged, can't even tie his own shoes. And the FBI supplied him with a cell phone because his parents wouldn't give him one. And he used that cell phone to make threats that are now the basis for his incarceration and facing charges of supporting terrorism, even though this kid can't even form a clear thought. And then we have the case announced yesterday, the sentencing of Shrimp Boy Chow. Raymond Chow, a notorious gang leader from San Francisco's Chinatown, went to prison in the 90s, got out by snitching on somebody else, claims he had reformed. And then the FBI sent a group of agents with a $1 million budget to entrap Shrimp Boy, a state senator named Leland Yee, Yee's associate who was raising money for his campaigns, a guy named Jackson. And yesterday, in federal court, Shrimp Boy Chow was sentenced to 2 life terms in prison and 20 years. A federal court convicted him of conspiring to operate the organization called the Gi Kung Tong as a racketeering enterprise. He was convicted of ordering the murder of its previous leader and he was also convicted for conspiring unsuccessfully to murder another rival. But all of this testimony came from compromised individuals. And he also was apparently bribed or received illegal payments from an FBI agent who was posing as a criminal himself. Now, that FBI agent was permitted to take the stand, but his defense attorneys, Chow's defense attorneys, were not permitted to know his name, to cross-examine him, to try to impeach him based on other cases he might have been involved in. And so the unconstitutional approach to law enforcement that has become commonplace in these sting operations and anti-terrorism cases was applied to a political corruption case where the FBI created the means and the methods for the crimes to occur. Now, Shrimp Boy told the judge in a one-hour-long statement that he is innocent, they got the wrong man. He blames his lawyers, and I know one of his lawyers, Tony Serra. And I understand that at this point, Shrimp Boy will blame his lawyers because that is one potential way to appeal the case down the road. But the lawyers chafed at the restrictions imposed by federal Judge Breyer. This is the brother of the Supreme Court Justice Breyer. And Breyer permitted the government to invoke state secrets. They convicted some people for attempting to bribe the mayor of San Francisco, Ed Lee, but they never investigated or indicted Ed Lee. And so this is a really squirrely case. And while I don't know Shrimp Boy, and, you know, he may have been responsible for these murders, or one murder and one attempted murder, I'm highly skeptical of the way the government operated in this case. And while some people may be crowing that Shrimp Boy is going to be put away for life plus, we've seen a huge injustice once again. Now, this is really astounding, and I credit Trevor Aronson. He now writes for The Intercept, and he published a book several years ago called Terror Factory, which exposed the FBI sting operations aimed at Muslims and so-called domestic terrorists. And this is a doozy. And it's a little complicated, so bear with me here. Now, you recall that last May 3rd, two men from Arizona armed with assault rifles went to Garland, Texas, where Pamela Geller had organized the first annual Muhammad Art Exhibit and Contest, a provocation intended to inflame Muslims. And it worked. These two guys came from Arizona, Elton Simpson and his roommate Nadir Sufi. The name to remember here is Simpson. He's at the center of this case because on Wednesday, in a new indictment filed in Charlotte, North Carolina, against a suspect named Eric Hendricks, the information supplied in an affidavit in the case reveals that there was an FBI undercover agent at that Draw Muhammad event in Garland, Texas, on May 3rd, 2015. And he was communicating with Hendricks, and Hendricks was in touch with Elton Simpson. Now, this becomes crucial because the FBI undercover agent shared information with Hendricks that he presumably, we can't be sure, but he presumably shared with Elton Simpson, who, with Sufi, was shot and killed by authorities in the parking lot of the hotel where this event was being held. Now, what is really incriminating is that the affidavit includes partial information about text messages that were sent by the undercover agent to Hendricks. In one exchange, Hendricks wrote to the undercover agent, "If you see that pig Geller, make your voice heard." Then Hendricks asked the agent a series of questions. How big is the gathering? How many people? How many cops? Do you see feds there? Now, from the affidavit, we don't know the responses of the FBI agent. Isn't that convenient? But if he shared information with Hendricks that was then relayed to Simpson, then it appears the FBI may have had an indirect role in triggering this event. And here is the most incriminating part. After Simpson posted a link to the Draw Muhammad event online, the undercover agent wrote, "Tear up Texas." And Simpson replied, "Bro, you don't have to say that. You know what happened in Paris, I think." He's referring to the Charlie Hebdo attack. "Right," the agent responded. So Simpson replied, "So that goes without saying." And after the Garland shooting, Hendricks, the guy who was just arrested this week, or indicted this week, posted a statement online in which he referenced the shooters as a new Muslim of 2 years and another of 11 years, referring to the two armed individuals. So we need to learn more about this. We certainly need to see the agent's side of the text message exchanges. But this is stunning information. It is widely available. But you won't see it covered on television news. You won't see it in the New York Times. You won't see it in corporate media. And this is the real serious problem that we face, that our media is complicit with the expanding police state in this country. And they spin up these crimes that are not related to terrorism, like Orlando, like the truck driver in Nice, and create the impression that we all should be hunkering down in fear because of the imminent threats posed by the Islamic State and its terrorist minions. And yes, there is a real Islamic State, and yes, there are people who are sympathetic to it, inspired by it, all that stuff. But so much of the activity in the counterterrorism domestic sector is purely concocted bullshit. And as it stacks up, the information that we have gets blurred, and we all just accept when we hear political leaders, like at the Republican and Democratic conventions, recite the list of attacks and interweave true terrorist attacks with these phony ones. And that's why I warn of the creeping police state. What could be, what other motive is available for our law enforcement agencies to create crimes, to participate in fictional busts, to lock up individuals who just were in the wrong place at the wrong time and believed an FBI informant? That is the essence of a police state, and we are there. A new poll shows that African Americans and Latinos, young ones, understand the risk they face from law enforcement. 2/3 of young African Americans and 4 in 10 Latinos say that they know someone or they themselves have experienced violence or harassment at the hands of police. That includes about 2 in 10 of each group who say that it was a personal experience, including 3 in 10 for black men who were asked that question. And yet, we see, following the unconscionable police murders in Dallas and Baton Rouge, this idea that the only response is to harden our police forces, militarize them, pass laws to protect them from honest investigations. And I don't think that our political leadership is addressing these issues in any meaningful way whatsoever. I think they're stoking them far too often. I want to recommend a commentary published at NewsBud this week. I'm linking to Todd McFarlane's piece, which, of course, is at the temporary site for NewsBud, boilingfrogspost.com. And you may recall, Todd McFarlane and I did a couple of podcast interviews in the early part of this year related to the standoff at that outpost in Oregon. And Todd McFarlane and I come to the issues of civil liberties and constitutional rights from very different perspectives. He is a conservative rancher. He's a lawyer. He has some ideas in common with the Bundys, not all. And I've grown to respect Todd McFarlane. And I encourage you to read his piece, where he takes a different tack about criminal investigations and prosecutions, the use of state secrets, and the need for transparency. I think it's a good piece, and I hope you'll read it over at the NewsBud/BoilingFrogsPost.com website. And speaking of NewsBud, Sibel Edmonds and the crew were in New York at in Manhattan's NBC headquarters at 30 Rockefeller Plaza, protesting NBC's false reporting of information related to the attempted coup on July 15th in Turkey. And there was interesting turnout, mostly from media from outside the United States. I haven't gotten a full report yet from Sibel, but when I do, I will share that with you in upcoming podcasts. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to this podcast. People like the extremely generous Gary Batterson, Paul Tomaselli, Tim McKay, Joey Perillo out there in Pennsylvania. They're all monthly subscribers to this podcast, and I invite you to join them. I ran some numbers yesterday, and I could sure use more supporters. The bills actually are about equal to the revenue that's coming in. So I am your volunteer podcaster here, and I do aspire to be paid. So if you're in a position to help with that, go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then pull down and click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page, and with a PayPal account, you can be up and running in just a couple of minutes. I appreciate your support, and thank you for listening and sharing this podcast far and wide. Well, I have to admit that I'm pretty stunned at the almost free fall of Donald Trump's polling numbers. Now, I want to be clear that the numbers or the polls where he has dropped the most are the polls that have the least impact because they're national favorability polls, and that doesn't really track how the election will work in November. Still, Trump has lost a lot of ground because of his attacks on the Mr. and Mrs. Khan who spoke at the Democratic National Convention and the way many supporters have peeled away from him in just the past week. So I went over to Real Clear Politics. They do a good job of compiling all the polls. And I'll just run down for you. This is an Atlanta Constitution poll in Georgia where Clinton is up by 4 points. In Georgia, when you add all of the candidates, Clinton is up by 3 points. That adds Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, by the way. then in the biggest gaps that have grown, the national polls, Trump versus Clinton by NBC News and the Wall Street Journal, shows Clinton leading by 9. The biggest gap she has is 15-point lead in the McClatchy-Marist poll, 48 to 33. Let's see what else I have here. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll, when you include all of the candidates, shows Clinton up by 9, and Jill Stein, for the first time, breaking 5 points. She also shows up, Jill Stein, 6 points in the McClatchy-Marist poll, where Clinton leads by 14 when you include Gary Johnson and Jill Stein in the mix. That's very interesting because they both, Stein and Johnson, appear to be drawing from Donald Trump more than Hillary Clinton. And in key battleground states like Florida, Clinton up 4, Michigan, Clinton up by 9, Pennsylvania, Clinton up by 11, and again, when you add the third-party candidates in Pennsylvania, Clinton's lead grows to 13 points with Jill Stein at 3, Gary Johnson at 7, and Trump at 34. So this is a very serious problem for the Republicans. But I caution you not to get giddy and think that this election is over by any means. And there's a good cautionary editorial in today's New York Times entitled "The Perils of Writing Off Mr. Trump." And the editorial says, "Democrats looking at a new 9-point poll lead for Clinton began wondering whether winning might be easier than they thought. David Axelrod, who ran Obama's campaign, joked that Hillary should take the summer to tour the national parks and let Trump just destroy himself. But the Times cautions, any celebration by Trump's opponents seems more than a bit premature. He is unlikely to go anywhere soon. It is unlikely that he will quit, even though there's been a lot of noise made about that in the past week. And they say it's also highly unlikely that there will ever emerge a better Donald Trump. We, says the Times, are far more likely to witness an even worse one. His support isn't contingent on exhibiting presidential behavior or shifting his energies to lofty discussions of public policy. In fact, it is contingent on the opposite." And they're politely making the point that I'll put this way. The people who support Donald Trump don't care about any of the things that have caused his drop in the poll. And they don't watch TV much, or at least they don't watch TV that's balanced, and they don't read the New York Times editorial page. And so I think it's very important to recognize that the campaign has another 96 days or so, and a lot can happen between now and November 8. Also in the Times today, a spook endorses Hillary. Mike Morrell, who was the deputy director of the CIA and also acting director for a while, goes to the editorial page of the Times for a full endorsement. He'll be voting for Hillary on November 8th because she's highly qualified. I trust she'll deliver on the most important duty, keeping our nation safe, and that Trump is not only unqualified but may pose a risk to our national security. Now, coming from the CIA, this is a curious endorsement. And, of course, it's one of the reasons why I can't support Hillary Clinton for president. Morrell writes, during the early debates about how we should respond to the Syrian civil war, she was a strong proponent of a more aggressive approach, one that might have prevented the Islamic State from gaining a foothold in Syria. That is complete and utter bullshit. And that is the hawkish sentiment that Hillary advanced and was rejected by President Obama, to his enduring credit. And to try to air out those issues from 2011 now and use hindsight to say, oh gosh, you know, if we just confronted them then, they never would have gotten a foothold in Syria. Well, that is pure I don't want to offend you by saying bullshit again, but that's the only word that comes to mind, friends. He's making it up. And this is what passes for informed commentary in our presidential campaign this year. Now, there are two great pieces that Reuters published in the past couple of days in reaction to the claims that it was Russia that hacked the Democratic National Committee's computer system and leaked those emails to WikiLeaks that have since become public. And James Bamford, the acknowledged worldwide expert on the National Security Agency, writes a piece that is really important. He says there's a strange irony. Russia, if it is actually involved in the hacking of the DNC, could be attempting to influence a U.S. election by leaking to the American public the falsehoods of its leaders. This is a tactic Washington used against the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and we haven't stopped. Most recently, NSA operations delved into elections in Mexico, reports Bamford, targeting its last presidential campaign. According to a leak from Ed Snowden, the operation involved a surge effort against one of Mexico's leading presidential candidates who actually won the election. We also interfered in the 2010 election in Mexico, that led to NSA access to the email account of the President Felipe Calderon. And Bamford points out that the NSA is growing considerably and that we operate the most successful aggressive cyber warfare operations in the world. It's not Russia, it's not North Korea, it's not China. Now under construction at Fort Meade, the Cyber Command's new $3 billion headquarters will include 14 buildings and an enormous 600,000-square-foot supercomputer facility, 60 megawatts of power. And he cites Snowden again, describing the NSA and the Cyber Command. It's an attack agency. It's all about computer network attack and computer network exploitation at Cyber Command. And Bamford goes on to quote a secret NSA document, "The next major conflict will start in cyberspace." One key phrase within Cyber Command documents is information dominance. So the cyber team at the Navy calls itself the Information Dominance Corps. The Cyber Army is providing frontline troops with the option of requesting cyber fire support from Cyber Command, in much the same way it requests air and artillery support. And at the Cyber Air Force, they pledge to dominate cyberspace just as we dominate air and space. Bamford reveals that in 2012 in Syria, according to Snowden, the NSA attempted to remotely and secretly install a bug into the computer system of a major internet provider, but it went sideways and it bricked the computers and took the internet across the country down for a period of time. So Bamford, I think, does us a great service in pointing out that the only widely known aggressive cyber attack in recent history was the Stuxnet attack on Iran that came from, we think, the U.S. and Israel. Now, in the same vein, my friend Peter Van Buren, the State Department whistleblower, also at Reuters on August 2nd, says that he's noticed that there is an uptick in referring to Vladimir Putin as a thug, and that this has heightened after the alleged hacks of the DNC, allegedly by the Russian government. So he quotes President Obama calling Putin a thug. Marco Rubio called him a gangster and a thug. House Speaker Paul Ryan's spokesperson said that Russia is a global menace led by a devious thug. Bernie Sanders called Muammar Gaddafi a thug. Secretary of State John Kerry called Bashar al-Assad a thug and a murderer. You get the point. Well, what Van Buren says is that the term thug is a signal that the United States has plans for you. And he says, enter Putin the thug, kind of a Hollywood casting character. And so the idea here is that he is the boogeyman of the moment, the guy we can blame things on to distract and divert attention from where the hack may have actually come from. And if you haven't figured it out by now, the leading suspect is our own NSA. Because there is now a sharing agreement that was put together by the Obama administration as an executive order. And so, if you work at the NSA, you can access most documents that are controlled by the FBI. Oh, you know, like Hillary's emails. And finally today, the New York Times, responding to the ravings of Donald Trump, I reported that earlier this week, how he fears that the election will be rigged and taken from him. Well, they zeroed in on just one aspect of what a rigged election might be like and then dismissed the possibility almost entirely. And they did this by quoting Trump, who said, "We may have people vote 10 times. It's inconceivable that you don't have to show identification in order to vote, or that the identification doesn't have to be somewhat foolproof. If you don't have voter ID, you can just keep voting and voting and voting." Only, that's never happened. The experts say that voter fraud occurs when people who didn't know they weren't allowed to vote register and vote, like people who have a green card. Or that occasionally, you know, people register with different addresses. And the bottom line is, most of the people who execute this kind of voter fraud by voting twice or voting when they shouldn't do so not with some criminal intent. But that's what Republicans want you to think, and that's what has spawned this whole voter suppression scheme linked to the fatuous claim that we need to secure elections with photo IDs for the voters. And in, what, about 10 column inches here, the New York Times focuses only on voter impersonation or those types of fraud activities. Doesn't mention anything related to election fraud, the changing of registration, the gaming of people's access, the scrubbing of voters, the requirement of photo IDs, and ultimately the manipulation of the tabulation of votes that are cast. Apparently at the New York Times, they're just not aware that that's even a possibility. Thanks for joining me. This is the News and Comment podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.